In Ezekiel 33, this chapter renews the prophet's role as watchman. Earlier, I guess the first few chapters, I think it's chapter 3, he kind of makes Ezekiel the watchman, stresses, and then here it kind of reaffirms him as the watchman, stresses personal responsibility for sin, confirms Jerusalem's fall, and warns that listeners must obey God's word, not just hear it. In a verse we have to go with this. Save them, as surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord. I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but prefer that the wicked change his behavior and live. Turn back from your evil deeds. Why should you die, O house of Israel? And that's very... to me, that's very comforting. No, the Lord doesn't want the wicked to die. He wants them to change. Ezekiel 33:20. Yet you say, the way of the Lord is not right. I will judge each of you according to his ways, house of Israel. So some people are just like today. There's people that, you know, oh, the Bible's all wrong, right? Or they twist the Bible. You know, they define what love is and say, well, Christians are unloving because, you know, they tell people that they're doing wrong. Well, the loving thing would be accept them. No, is it really? Is it really? Loving thing is to tell people, you know, what's best for them. Whatever that would be. Chapter 34. God condemns Israel's selfish shepherds, the leaders, for neglecting the flock. He promises to shepherd his people himself, seek the lost, and heal the injured, judge justly, and establish a future with his servant David. You think, well, what's that future? What's that future? Because there's never going to be another Davidic kingdom, right? Except for the kingdom of Christ.
I think he's asking that the...
Pardon me?
That the shepherds are not looking for the flock. They're not being taught.
Yeah, which is so unlike a shepherd. Yeah, because we lived in Sicily, and they had... when we lived in Sicily, it was near Naval Air Station Sigonella. We had traffic jams, you know, going to and coming from work, but they weren't normal traffic jams. There were shepherds with their flock, and so you learned. So I guess being there, you just learned a little bit about, you know, at least these shepherds. You know, how they use their staff. They could, you know, you always wonder, you know, what do they use that staff for? And I don't know if they did this in ancient times, but they would, you know, they'd have the flock out ahead of them, maybe 100 yards stretch, you know, maybe not that far, because I guess they couldn't throw the staff that far. But they would, but then they would, to get the, we call them geep, because they're kind of gauche. Goat sheep. It's kind of a joke, but anyway. They would throw, I guess they were sheep, but they would throw that staff down the road, and they would, and it seems like they would throw it to the side they wanted it to go. So you'd throw it, and they'd hear, and they would hear that staff, you know, hit the ground, and they would move toward it. And instead of away, like you would think, and then they would move off the road, and then people could at least drive. We had another road I could take. I guess the main road I could take home. I didn't like it. I guess I would rather wait on the sheep. But Because there, if you drove the speed limit, a car would pass, well, if you left enough room between you and the car ahead of you, a car would pull it right in there. And also, they told you when you moved there about double passing, what's that mean? Double passing, and this is a two-lane road, basically. It's a wide two-lane road, but, you have cars just going each way, and their idea of double passing is they'll have one car pass you, okay, no problem, and it's kind of on the center line. They kind of treat the center line as a passing line. By law, it's that way. You're supposed to veer to the right, and the center line is really the passing lane. And then a car would be passing that car. So, that's double pass. I have to call it double passing, where, a car would be passing you in the center line, and then someone would pass them and you in that outer one. So I didn't like to mess with that. I would just take the back roads and deal with the sheep most of the time, unless I was in the mood. But learned a lot about shepherds, I guess, because they were always with their flock, for sure. They would never, ever be out there, let them out there. Ezekiel 35, God pronounces judgments on Mount Seir, which is Edom. So that's to the south, southeast. I guess it's kind of south of the Dead Sea. For its hatred of Israel, violent actions during Judah's downfall, and prideful boasting, Edom's land will become desolate, and they will know that God is Lord. Ezekiel 35:35. You have shown unrelenting hostility and poured the people of Israel onto the blades of the sword at the time of their calamity, at the time of their final punishment. Therefore, as surely as I live, declares the Lord, the Sovereign Lord, I will subject you to bloodshed, and bloodshed will pursue you. Since you did not hate bloodshed, bloodshed will pursue you. And these are judgments against Edom. I will turn Mount Seir into a desolate ruin. I will cut off from it one who passes through the returns. And it is, to me, it's already desolate. I'm sure people have had places to live there, but if you look there, it's a pretty desolate area. As far as I know, if you stand there and look at the Dead Sea, the whole area looks desolate to me. Except where they do some irrigation down by the, people lived, I don't understand how people live in the, I guess, I don't understand how people live in the desert, it looks desolate, maybe don't look desolate to look desolate to them, and a lot of Israel, I guess, very interesting, you think is, most of the pictures you look at Israel and the biblical lands is, you usually think of desert, and really it's not. Really, it's about half-half. If you drive up from Joppa, is that okay? I can't remember what that's called today, but anyway. agency of Joppa up to Jerusalem, I mean, you really feel like you're driving through the Ozarks. I mean, it's kind of, I was kind of surprised, you know, you're kind of driving through the trees and the whole coastal land there is, you know, so that the land that's next to the coastline, you know, it's not the greenest place I've ever seen by any stretch, but it, you know, it's not desert. And the interesting thing about Jerusalem itself, is like, well, on the east side, of Jerusalem, it goes from, it turns from, you know, the amount of rainfall that falls in Jerusalem, like one, like the main part of Jerusalem compared to the, you know, I think within 100 yards, it just turns to complete desert. You know, a reasonable, you have a reasonable amount of, like maybe 20 inches, 18 inches. I think it's like 18. You go from like 18 inches of rainfall to 2 inches of rainfall. And I maybe, I'm sure I'm off on this, but it's something dramatic like that, like 18 down to 2 in 100 yards going toward the Dead Sea. And it's that way going, and it, and it's kind of a peninsula of rainfall. If you look at it, it's the north and the south too. It's, you know, you get 100 yards away from the, from Jerusalem and it's desert, but you know, Jerusalem's not. And then, but to the west, you kind of have a, it's kind of connected. You have, you know, so, you know, maybe 18 inches of rainfall to the west. You have a corridor, but it's kind of a peninsula surrounded by desert there. I'm sticking out to the west. Have to put that on a map. Find those correct stats and put it on a map. But it is amazing because you just look from Jerusalem, you know, it's a nice place, and you look down and it just turns into desolation. Like you know, the like the people that walked, you know, saw John the Baptist, right? That down to the Jordan River. You know, they walked through, that was basically probably, I don't know how long it took them, you know, but it's probably pretty much a day's walk, at least half a day's walk to get down there, and it's through desert. Now, you know, the good thing is you can see where you're going. You can see that, there, you know, the river down there and stuff. But, I mean, it would, I mean, that was quite, I mean, that was, you know, that's not like today. You just driving over, you know, to hear somebody preach, you just drive over and see them. But, you know, they had to, you know, walk and walk and walk to see John the Baptist. So anybody that was down there to see him, you know, just didn't happen by, right? I mean, you had to make very big effort, very specific effort to go hear John the Baptist preach. Okay, Ezekiel 35:14. This is what the Lord God says. As all the earth rejoices, I will make you a desolation. Okay, 36. God promised to restore the land of Israel and bless it abundantly and bring his people back. He will cleanse them, give them a new heart and spirit, and show his holiness among the nations. Ezekiel 36:26, one of the most beautiful verses in Ezekiel. I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new spirit within you. I will remove the heart of stone from your body and give you a heart of flesh. Please don't ask. It's beautiful, but don't ask me to explain it. you know how God does that. But, and then... I will put my spirit within you. I will take the initiative, and you will obey my statute and carefully observe my regulations. you know, and I guess the thing for me, obviously, they need to turn, right? God didn't force these people to obey him, but they turned to him. Ezekiel 36:28. Then you will live in the land I gave to your fathers. You will be my people, and I will be your God. And I really like that. I think I looked that up. How many times is that kind of verbiage, you know? I will be your God, and you will be my people, basically, right? And that's roughly in the Bible, totally, that's in there about, not exact wording, but, you know, very close to that kind of wording. It's 15 times, I think. You know, all through the Bible, starting, I think maybe in Exodus and goes to Revelation. But I think it's mostly Jeremiah and two in Ezekiel. Ezekiel 37. Ezekiel sees a valley of dry bones. I guess let's go back one. Because I think in the end, you know, you think, well, what does God want, right? What does God really want? You know, why did he create the world? You know, knowing that the vast majority of the people would not follow him. You know, why did he do that? And I think the answer is really in this verse, that he wanted, more than anything, he wants to be a people's God, and, you know, and have that people be, have him be God, and they be his people. So he wants people to obey him. People, he wants a group of people to obey him and to trust him, and, you know, have them be, he can be their God and they can be his people. Because, you know, that used to bother me a lot, like, you know, why? Why did God create this, you know, mess? You know, where most people are going to be lost. You know, but the main thing, more than anything, overriding for him is, you know, he wants a people to love him. He wants a people that will choose to love him. Ezekiel 37, and here's a vision. I didn't know that. This is a vision, because it's, you know, spoken of being so literal, and you know, perhaps it was, you know, temporary literal. But Ezekiel sees a valley of dry bones brought to life, symbolizing Israel's national restoration. God unites Judah and Israel, promises his spirit, and establishes servant David as a shepherd over a united lasting kingdom. So this vision is to that shows that, you know, they're going to, you know, Israel's going to change. Israel's going to, you know, turn back to God. And you think about it, for God, you know, whether it's a vision or for real, it doesn't make that much difference to God, right? I mean, God doesn't do extravagant miracles like he could, right? If you think about it, I guess one thing I always said, that, you know, God could just plop up the Superdome and plop it in the middle of I-40, right? You know, I mean, you know, he could do stuff like that. You know, it'd be nothing for him, right? You know, and even that would be nothing, right? I mean, he could, you know, anything you can imagine, he could just, you know, he could change the course of rivers in a moment, and, you know,
Wouldn't some of this that he's talking about, like in 36, where he's, 36, where he's talking about the Gentiles, some of this towards the end where he's talking basically of the Gentiles and the Israelite life for the all the worlds coming together?
It could be. I mean, I don't know. I should have grabbed my Bible. I just have my slideshow.
What do you want?
That's okay. Yeah, I should have snagged it. But yeah, thanks for the comment. Yeah, and that's, yeah, I think you're right. I will, 37:14, I will place my breath in you, and you will live. I will give you rest in your own land. Then you will know that I am the Lord. I have spoken and I will act, declares the Lord. And another verse out of 37. My dwelling place also will be among them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. So this two chapters in a row you have that wording. 38. God warns of a future invasion of Gog and Magog against the restored peaceful Israel. Though powerful, Gog will be defeated by divine intervention so that all nations know that the Lord is sovereign. I will exalt and magnify myself. I will reveal myself before many nations, then they will know that I am the Lord. God declares total defeat of Gog's armies. Their destruction reveals his glory. Israel is restored, never again to be shamed. God pours out his spirit, affirming his covenant and presence among the people forever. Ezekiel 39:29. I will no longer hide my face from them. I will pour out my spirit on the house of Israel, just declares the sovereign Lord. Ezekiel 40. In a vision is transported to Israel where a heavenly guide shows him the detailed measurements of a future temple. The vision marks the beginning of God's restored presence among his people. So this is the start. This is like the whole rest of the book. Is really just talking about Jerusalem and the temple. And I guess up front, it's a vision. It's, you know, if you go there, it's, and these are kind of, I guess, exaggerated measurements. You know, if you try to just measure it out and say, okay, this, you know, it's not a blueprint for the new temple. It's just not. If you look at it, you know, it's, it don't fit, right? I mean, it doesn't fit, you know, the Temple Mount or the city of Jerusalem. You know, it's an exaggeration. And for them, it was obvious, right? You know, today we can tell when people exaggerate, right? That it's, if you know the context, yeah, he's just exaggerating. You know, it's just a ideal, I guess you would say the ideal temple, ideal city of Jerusalem, ideal, but in a vision, it's not, and he gives all these measurements, you know, so you think, oh, it's for real, you know, this is the, you know, he's laying out a blueprint. No, it's still just a vision, it's still just an ideal. And it is pretty awesome, you know. I should have had some of the pictures that people have come up with from this, and it's a beautiful place. You know, you look, you know, it's, I don't know what the most beautiful, I guess you'd say campus I'd ever seen, but you know, I've seen, I guess maybe Washington D.C. you know, just the way Washington, D.C. is laid out. I mean, it's very, very beautiful, right? You have like a center, Washington Monument in the center, then you have, you know, Capitol, White House, Lincoln Memorial, Jeff Jefferson Memorial, on the north, south, east, and west. I mean, it's just a beautiful setting. And it started as a swamp. If you read the history books, you know, I guess they picked it because, you know, I guess that's what people are willing to give. You know, but it, you know, started out as a swamp, and now it's just a beautiful, beautiful city. But this is, you know, God's vision of an ideal, you know, Jerusalem and temple. That's what these, I guess, nine chapters are about here. Ezekiel 40, verse 2, by means of divine visions, he brought me to a place that was on a high mountain, and was, and it was structured like a city to the south. Where he brought me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze, and a thread of flax, and a measuring rod in his hand, and he was standing in the gateway. And this rod, so this measuring rod, I guess it's 6 cubits. So if that was a normal cubit, a normal cubit's 18 inches. So you think, okay, this rod's, this rod's 6 cubits, okay, 9 feet. Well, that's not quite right. Because these are extra big cubits, and it states in there that it's a cubit plus a handbreadth. So, you know, so across here, so I guess 4 inches. So it's 18 inches from here to here is 18 inches, and then the width of your hand. And I got small hands. And it's about 4 inches, so I guess for this, it's 22 inches times six, whatever that is. I guess about 4 inches, 9 feet, four times six, 4 inches, 4 inches times six, 24 plus nine. I guess that's 11 feet exactly. So these rods, so he must have an 11 foot rod. So you, okay, and here, so I guess in this version that I had here, I was talking to him earlier, I try to do everything in New American Standard for this, but sometimes my Bible software defaults, I think, to the NET Bible, which is a good Bible, but I don't like this, you know. Because I guess in their wisdom, they thought that, oh, we'll just change it. You know, we'll just change it to what, you know, what people can understand. You know, no. I mean, to me, with units, you keep it the way it is. I mean, you just do it what it says, and then, you know, off to the side, you know. You just do it. I mean, I guess this version, whatever, I think probably NET, but I guess it popped up as my default. I thought I had New American Standard, but it changes on me. Okay. And the holy place. So if you look at, if you think of a basketball, you think about, you know, how big is the holy place and the Holy of Holies. So roughly, if you take like a college basketball court and the length of it. So the length of all this is about the length of a college, you know, within like 4 feet. It's like the length of a college basketball court. And the width is about 2/3 of a basketball court. So it's like the length of the basketball court to the side, to the opposite side, and going the other direction. It's not the whole full width of the basketball court. It's to the, it's about 2/3. So it's about to the free throw line, the free throw lane line, to one side. So it's like a basketball court with one slice off of it. So about roughly 2/3 of that. And then about 2/3 of that is the holy place, and the holy of holies is about 1/3 of that. It's half as big as the other, so it's about 1/3 of a basketball court. So it's about 1/3 by 1/3, I guess. If you look at one end, so it'd be like, where the guys stand for three throws to maybe the 5-point line, if that makes any sense. That's kind of the Holy of Holies size. So I guess a little bit bigger than this room. The vision continues with the chambers for priests and sacred offerings. These rooms surround the temple and emphasize separation between the holy and common. The temple area is measured, reinforcing God's holiness and order of worship. And he measured all four sides and had a wall around it, 875 feet. And back to feet again. Sorry about that. By 875 feet to separate the holy and common places. So I guess they have these layers, right, where, so 1,000 feet, I guess, somewhere between a 1/4 of a mile and a quarter, a 1/4 of a mile, I think is, 1,200 feet, so this is, I guess this is less than a 1/4 mile. My math. Yeah. Okay, summary. God's glory returns to the temple, filling it as in Solomon's day. Ezekiel receives instructions for the altar and offered. This marks the renewed covenant, emphasizing reverence, holiness, and God's permanent dwelling place among his people. Then a wind lifted me up and brought me to the inner court, and I watched the glory of the Lord filling the temple. So, this is sweet, because if you remember back in chapter 10, right? You have that vision of God, you have the vision of the glory of God and these four creatures, and you think, oh, that's a cool chapter, talking about the glory of God, except you read that one verse where it says, it's the glory of God departing. And you're like, oh, bummer. Well, here, it seems to be the opposite. The glory of the Lord, is coming back. Ezekiel 43:19. You shall give to the Levitical priests who are from the descendants of Zadok, who come near me to serve me, declares the Lord, a bull as a sin offering. So this is part of the, and it's still the vision. All this is vision. Ezekiel 44. Regulations for the temple worship are restored. The east gate is shut, symbolizing God's presence. Only consecrated Levites may serve. The priests must live holy lives, teaching the people distinguish between the sacred and the profane. Looks like we're going to time this about right. Okay.
Roger, sorry to go back, but I have a quick question. Back in 38, uh-huh. Who is Gog and Magog? And why are they cities? Are they figurative?
Honestly, I don't know.
And then being referenced later in Revelation. I mean, all this just feels so like random and pointless, but it's obviously important if it's in reference later in the New Testament. I mean, we know that it was important to the Jews to have all these details and measurements and just the grandiosity of the temple and the vision, just as a consolation to them. But on the other hand, it's just hard to imagine why the fall of those two, if they're cities or if they're people.
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know if it's really that clear, because I guess I take it people, invaders from the north, but you know exactly who those invaders are. I guess I have to figure that out. Sorry.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, because I'm just trying to learn this book. I worked on this lesson once earlier in the week, and then I had to do a. I knew it wasn't up snuff, so last night I went to bed, woke up at 10 p.m., took a nap, and worked on it from like 10 p.m. to midnight, so I guess past midnight. So this morning, I worked on it this morning. But yeah, I definitely don't have all the answers on Ezekiel. But yeah, it's a good question. But I know it's in Revelation, and I think like somehow for some reason I associate it with northern Israel, but you know, coming from the north, but I really don't know. Ezekiel 44:31, the priest shall eat any bird or animal that has died a natural death or has been torn to pieces by animals. Well, that's good advice, right? I mean, even today, yeah, you don't want to do that. I mean, yeah, if you're starving. But for these guys, right, it would have been... they weren't supposed to eat the blood. I guess, and really in the New Testament too. If you look at Acts 15, there's the letter from the Jerusalem Council. You know, it says don't eat things that have been strangled, right? You know, don't eat anything with the blood in it. You know, and don't eat blood and. And I don't see anywhere in Scripture where that's ever, rescinded. You know, so to me, it's still today, the one thing that Christians, as far as I know, Christians should not eat something. You think, oh, that's all just the Jews and, other groups. But Christians probably shouldn't eat stuff, with the blood in it, or eat stuff with blood, made with blood. And actually, very few people, and we don't, right? I mean, as a general rule, we eat a steak, well, the blood's been drained out of it, just like the only thing I know of people eating with blood is in Louisiana, they have blood sausage. Sounds gross, but so I find it ironic, the people that make up rules of what we can't eat, are the same people that eat things that God said not to eat. How shall I put that, right? I don't know. Anyway, that's my rant. Okay, 44:31. Okay, summary. A sacred district is defined, setting aside land to the sanctuary priests, Levites, justice, honest weights, and fair offerings are required. Festivals are reestablished to promote righteousness and unity in worship across the land. You must use just balances, a just dry measure, an ephah, and just a liquid measure, a bath. Yeah, so somebody who's using unfair measurements, you know, that's just not fair, right? I mean, and even today, it's one of my favorite places to go get food. If you go ask for a pound, there's a restaurant in town. If you ask for a pound of brisket, you get a ton of brisket. It's a barbecue place, and if you go there, you know, to take it home. And if you ask for a pound of pulled pork, you just get a little thing, you know. And I'm like, I guess I get the brisket. But you know, I guess that's a small thing, but you know, you just think, well, you know, if somebody were to do that on a large scale, right, a merchant could just, you know, rip people off coming and going both ways and, you know, cheat people. Is that second bell? Van, could you lead us in prayer?